And we're back here in Cranston, Rhode Island at the 17th annual ASD Symposium. We're actually here on Friday, March 16th. Yesterday we had Deborah Lipsky with us on March 15th. Today we are very, very honored, privileged, and pleased to have Dr. Brenda Fawcett, who just finished, just like I would say 5-10 minutes ago, doing an entire 6 hours on different apps that are out there, which I hope we can go into some of that. It was a fantastic presentation.
Thank you.
And thank you for taking your busy time to do this interview.
My pleasure.
Can you give us kind of to start off with kind of an icebreaker to let us know of your background?
Sure. I started as a teacher of deaf children with multiple disabilities in 1993 in Vancouver, BC, and taught deaf kids with multiple disabilities for about 11 years there. And more recently completed my doctoral degree at the University of British Columbia, where I worked with Joe Lucician, primarily around positive behavior support, working with families of individuals with autism and other developmental disabilities. So my background is kind of varied. Deaf kids, hearing kids, individuals with developmental disabilities, positive behavior support, literacy development, kind of all over the place.
And you did your master's thesis, something to do with picture to text for SightWorld?
Right.
SightWord, actually, SightWord.
Right. I used a picture to text matching strategy to teach individuals with developmental disabilities to read a set of sight words. And I was actually looking at comparing two different instructional strategies. So I was comparing teaching kids to match a picture to the printed word versus showing kids a card that had both the picture and the printed word, and which one of those strategies worked best in terms of their ability to learn a set of sight words. And you know, what we found and what supported some of the research that was already out there was that teaching kids with autism in particular or other developmental disabilities to match a picture to a printed word was more effective because they needed to be actively engaged in the process of looking at that picture and finding the word that represented that picture.
Now, can this method also work with children who are deaf?
Absolutely.
And would it work the same way, or how would that work?
In exactly the same way, I mean, in terms of teaching sight word reading, the thing about children who are typically developing and deaf is that they generally don't have that much difficulty learning how to read sight words. If they have sign language skills, you point to the printed word, you show them the sign for it, they learn what it is, just like typical hearing children might learn how to read words. The issue around using pictures for individuals with developmental disabilities is that often they have spoken language challenges. So they don't understand the spoken word and how the spoken word, the written word, and whatever that word represents all come together and mean the same thing. So using pictures can help kids understand that the text means something.
Mm-hmm.
Right. For typically developing kids, whether they're hearing or deaf, generally we don't need to use those kinds of strategies, though certainly they can work.
What are some of the similarities or differences, say, children who are deaf with autism versus, or not versus, I'm not trying to set this up to be some kind of a confrontation, but say children who are not deaf and have autism?
I mean, the difference really is their access to information. Certainly kids who are hearing and have autism have auditory access to language, whereas kids who are deaf don't. But the similarity really is that, you know, whereas deaf kids with autism don't hear spoken words, hearing kids with autism often have difficulty processing spoken words. So although their ear works fine, their brain doesn't interpret the spoken language very well. So that's where many of the strategies that I used for deaf children with autism also work for hearing children with autism and vice versa,
mm-hmm.
because we use more visually mediated strategies, picture-based strategies. And so whether you don't hear language or you have difficulty processing language, the visual supports facilitate understanding.
Now, in addition to working on different strategies and some of your research, you've also developed things like home-based or the alternative...
Augmentative and alternative communication.
That's right.
Yeah.
Can you explain that or describe that for our listeners?
Sure. Augmentative and alternative communication, or AAC, is a field both of research and practice that's been around for decades to support individuals who have a variety of challenges in terms of communicating. So individuals with physical disabilities who can't speak may point to pictures or point to devices, to letters on devices or pictures on devices, and the devices speak for them. Individuals with autism may point to pictures, point to pictures on devices, or exchange pictures. People who are elderly and are losing skills that they previously had, so individuals with Alzheimer's, for example, or individuals with Lou Gehrig's disease who used to be able to speak but can no longer, may also use augmentative and alternative communication strategies, essentially to do for them what their voice can't do. So for some individuals, that may be a permanent strategy. They have cerebral palsy. They can't speak. They may never speak. And for some individuals, it may be temporary. So an individual who is in the hospital after an accident and has a trach and isn't able to speak because they have a trach may use augmentative and alternative communication for the short term until the trach is removed and they're able to speak again.
How has technology helped that? This kind of gets into some of what we were experiencing today with apps. So
right.
how has technology played a role in this kind of communication?
Right. Well, for several years, for decades really, we've had quite expensive technological devices that individuals use for AAC. So we moved from paper-based systems to technological systems that were quite costly, $5,000, $7,000, $10,000 devices, and certainly very effective, but they are expensive. With, for example, the iPad coming out and some of the other tablet computers and apps, they cost a lot less. So the AAC technology that we've had around for a while is now becoming more accessible to more people.
What amazed me today, because I think when we first started corresponding back and forth, I'm not saying that you kind of played it down, but you sort of said that this was not your major area. That is to say, the whole issue of apps on the presentation that you did today was not your, I'm going to say, primary area.
Right.
Yet today, a number of things ran through my mind as I was listening. Number one, you kind of reminded me of a consumer advocate because, you know, what works and the cost. And second, it amazed me. I'm saying, thinking to myself, boy, this kind of presentation should be kind of taken in little pieces and shown on community access television stations. I don't know if they have them up in Canada, but we have like community access television stations. And I was just amazed at how you handled it and the clippings that you showed on how some of the apps work. What got you into doing these kinds of workshops?
I'm a technology person. I enjoy technology myself. I've worked in the field of special ed and using augmentative and alternative communication for some time. And when the iPad came out and apps came out, certainly there was a great deal of interest in being a technology person. I was paying attention. I myself got interested in using some of the apps. I was consulting with a couple of families and we were using a few apps and trying some things out. But certainly there was an interest and people approached me knowing that I'm a technology kind of girl and pretty much asked if this is something that I would be interested in putting together is essentially what was today, a show and tell of here are a bunch of different apps to address a number of skill areas that are available for parents, for teachers, for other professionals to use with their students, their adult clients, whoever that they're working with.
How is it possible to keep up? I mean, even today, as you started out, and as we're taping this podcast, yet another iPad came out, and you can tell I'm not as technologically literate as I should be, but a new iPad is it that came out today, the iPad 3?
Yes, today.
Just as we record this? So what are the issues in terms of getting used to it, getting kids used to using the different apps and the different iPods? How can you keep up with all of this when yet another one comes out and it keeps changing sometimes every few months?
Right. Well, in terms of the iPad itself, the changes aren't significant for most of the kid users. So the changes are things like the iPad 1 didn't have a camera, the iPad 2 has a camera, the iPad 3 has a better camera. So those are the kinds of changes. In terms of the apps work across all of the iPads because it's the same software platform. So someone who had an app on an iPad 1 can use it on an iPad 2 and can use it on an iPad 3. In terms of how the apps are accessed, it's a fairly small set of skills, and you teach a child how to tap, how to drag, some of the kinds of motor skills that they need to use to access apps. And once they know how to do that, those kinds of skills go across apps. So what we're finding is that particularly with touchscreen devices like the iPad, that it's quite intuitive for most of the kids, certainly that I see and certainly that my colleagues see. We put an iPad in front of them and it takes very little instruction for them to know how to access it. We need to spend time teaching them the kinds of skills we want to use in terms of the app to teach, whether it's a social skill or a literacy skill or a math skill. We need to teach those skills. But in terms of kids picking up the iPad and knowing how to interact with it, it's fairly intuitive and most individuals have very little difficulty kind of picking it up and knowing how to use it.
So is it an ongoing training tool or is it something, I mean, it's not something like I can learn how to use this in 5 minutes or, you know what I'm trying to get at? How long would it take to teach someone to actually use some of the apps and iPads?
Well, it depends on what apps you're talking about and what skills you're talking about addressing. There are, you know, some apps that I talked about today that are just simple cause effect, learn how to touch the screen and make things happen. Most kids are going to learn how to do that in a matter of minutes. There are other apps that are meant to be used more long term. So some of the augmentative and alternative communication apps kids certainly learn how to access it. I touch a particular picture. If I touch the picture of Apple, the device says, I want an Apple. But they also need to learn how to navigate through multiple screens of pictures. How do they find the Apple when they want the Apple? Or how do they make a sentence? How do they say, I want a red apple versus I want a green apple? How do they know to make sure that there's a communication partner there to tell something to and not just press and have the device speak when they're in a room alone? So some of those bigger skills might take weeks or months, whereas other skills might literally take a few minutes to teach.
Colors aren't the only one, because I'm thinking, what if you had someone who was colorblind? So colors aren't the only apps that you would necessarily use, is that right?
Or... Oh, no, absolutely. There are apps for essentially every kind of learning skill you could imagine. Letters, numbers, shapes, objects, descriptive words, right? So if you're teaching just receptive vocabulary kinds of things, but there's also reading and math and science and social studies, social skills, all kinds of apps to teach all kinds of skills. There are literally tens of thousands of apps.
In addition to your work in technology, you also have developed home-based communication skills for families. I wonder if you can go into that a little bit.
Most of my work with families actually centers around positive behavior support, which is within the broad field of applied behavior analysis. I work with families who have kids who engage in quite challenging problem behavior. And so part of my work is going in and working collaboratively with the family to understand why the child might be engaging in problem behavior and to develop strategies to prevent the problem behavior, to teach new skills to the children to replace the problem behavior, because typically kids are behaving badly for a reason, for a good reason, and it's often that they don't have another skill. And so we need to teach some replacement skills. And then also teaching parents how to reinforce the behavior that they want their kids to engage in and not reinforce the problematic behavior. So that's most of my work that I do with families. And some of that work does also involve augmentative and alternative communication. So if I have a child who's engaging in problem behavior because they want mom's attention, and the only way they have to gain mom's attention is by hitting their little brother and they don't speak, I might need to go in and teach them to use augmentative and alternative communication, a different way to communicate to mom that they would like her attention, that's better than hitting their little brother.
So you would not only work with the parents, but you would work with the family.
I work with the whole family. Most of my work is certainly teaching, you know, parents and other family members how to support their child, as opposed to me coming in and taking their child and doing one-on-one work. I teach the family skills that they're going to be able to use throughout the life of parenting their child.
Now, you're on the faculty, I think it's the British Columbia University?
The University of British Columbia, okay. Yes. I'm an instructor there.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So what kind of courses might you be teaching there?
Right now, I'm primarily responsible for a Master of Education cohort that we have on Vancouver Island, which is a little ferry ride away from Vancouver. And we have 14 students. Most of them are special education teachers. Some of them are working in community-based settings. And so the courses that I teach range from an introduction to autism, teaching students with autism, courses on positive behavior support, courses on instructional strategies, courses on augmentative and alternative communication. So within the field of special education is where I teach.
Do you have an opportunity at the University of British Columbia to do the kinds of presentations, say, for example, that you did here today?
Not through UBC per se, but there's an organization in BC called Autism Community Training that's quite similar to the organization here in Rhode Island that does the same kind of thing, and they set up workshops around the province of British Columbia. So, for example, last month I did this particular workshop on Vancouver Island, and later this month I'll be in the interior of BC in Kamloops, and then up north in Prince George doing the same workshop.
Well, Dr. Fawcett, I want to thank you, first of all, for, again, I can't emphasize strongly, taking time out of a long day of presenting with us today, and also with your assistance in helping me, because I'm technologically, I don't know, a gnat, but in helping me to prepare for this interview. And thank you so much. It was an honor to have you as a presenter today, and it was an honor to have done this interview with you.
It's very much my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And I want to remind our listeners that music that was used, A Presence on Your Journey, which I forgot to tell everybody is the name of our program, was written by George Winston. And our technical producer has been Nathan Domain, and the editor, it will be Nicholas Domain. And you can hear this podcast and other previous podcasts by going to our website, which is www.community-autism-resources.com. And A Presence on Your Journey is also available in iTunes. And my name is Dennis Pulselli, and until next time, thank you for listening.